Midlands today on Midlands 103 with Tullamore Motors, the all-new Renault Megane. Feel the drive. TullamoreMotors.ie. When people in the Midlands want to talk, they talk to Will Faulkner.
Oh, that's a nice day. If only George Clooney was coming here when the sun shines. That's all we can hope for. But will it be to Abbey Leaks? Will it be to Wind Gap? Will he just travel to Kerry? To a beach somewhere? Who knows? But if we get an inside track, we will share with you today. So how are you otherwise? Lots to get through, including still no deal on farm emissions. Will they be reduced by 22%? Will they be reduced by 30%? And how is it they keep talking for so long? If you were haggling with somebody, you would not be day and night locked in a room saying 22, 30, 22, 30. I know they're probably going through it line by line and policy by policy and so on and so forth, but heavens above, it's a very long, drawn out, tedious process. Also today, life as a prison officer. What is it really like? And with the bank holiday upon us almost, some cocktails. We've talked wine before. We've talked craft beer before. What about cocktails? Go on, admit it. You have a cocktail when you go abroad. Especially the gents don't have one when they get home. So, anyway, it's becoming more and more acceptable. And we'll have some recipe ideas for cocktails very, very soon. When you call, 0818 300 103 is the Midlands 103 comment line. You can text or WhatsApp 083 3010 103, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. What have we got for you on the front pages this morning? The Irish Times tells you that builders cannot be levied over defective homes. So the builders who ignored standards or just didn't care about standards and built homes that are not fit for purpose and charged for them and put the money in the bank will not be paying to fix them up. It'll be you, it'll be me, it'll be Mr. and Mrs. Taxpayer. And the price tag is €2.5 billion, according to a new report that has landed on the desk of Housing Minister Dara O'Brien. One of the reasons these builders won't be paying for it? Because they're not builders anymore. Because their companies no longer exist. Boomtime builders who went bust. The other story on the front of the Irish Times is about the Climate Action Plan, which is causing so much consternation in farming circles at the moment. But the previous climate plans, the previous promises we have made, have we kept them? No, would appear to be the answer in almost half of cases. The article says that almost half of all measures in the government's climate action plan have not been implemented. A progress report, which was presented at yesterday's cabinet meeting, found just 45% of the measures due to be taken in April, May and June were actually implemented. Aye. And I wonder which sectors are the best boys in class and which sectors are not pulling their weight. A fair cop is the headline on the Irish Daily Star. It talks about the man who burgled Conor McGregor's pub and claimed he was hiding from a jealous husband. I think I've heard it all now. The Gorthy must hear some excuses over the years. That could be another book. Whatever about prison officers, I'm sure Gorthy could write a story or two. And then to the Irish Independent, you see a woman holding, you know, the hairdryer that the Gorthy use to catch speeding motorists? Well, Mary McCarthy is her name, and she decided to carry out an experiment. So she stood outside her home with what is not an official Gartha speed gun, but it works. It gives her an accurate measurement. And she found only 1 in 20 cars obeying the speed limit. 1 in 20. She lives in an urban area in a 30-kilometre zone. Oh, boy. We have a 30-kilometre zone along the main street in Port Arlington. That could be an interesting experiment. Stand out there with a hairdryer someday and see if you get any strange looks. What else have we got for you? Yes, grocery habits. Because inflation is now at a 14-year high. This you know already, hardly news. According to the Irish Independent, shoppers are spending more on own label goods in all the major supermarkets. So we're not buying the big brands as much as we used to. I think the exception there is probably alcohol because of the minimum pricing rules. Other stories. The British are building a surveillance ship at quite a price tag too, billions and billions. And its purpose is to protect us, in effect. You know, the undersea cables that extend from Europe to North America, through which all of our internet traffic passes and our phone calls and so much important and vital communication. Well, the British got quite a scare earlier this year when Russia was conducting its naval exercises in the Irish Economic Zone. And so they have decided to build a multi-role ocean surveillance ship which will monitor those cables and alert us and alert wider Europe if there is any problem. That's nice of the British to do. Apparently there's no collaboration with the Irish government. We're not putting our own money in there, which possibly we should, since it's in our interest and it's in our water. But let's not say anything if we don't have to put the money in. COVID-19 testing. You remember all the test centres that were dotted across the country? Some of them have already closed down. The government has agreed the end of COVID-19 testing for the general public. The recommendation was accepted yesterday to wind down all test centres come the autumn, so testing will only now take place when a doctor requires the result for his or her patient. Not sure how that's any different before. You had to go to a GP to get the appointment in the first place. Anyway, Pat McDonough of Supermax has built an empire, not alone the takeaway chain, but also hotels and motorway plazas. So he knows a thing or two about business. And in fairness, he's got his finger to the pulse of the food industry. And he predicts there will be food shortages this winter. And you might scoff and you might say, well, they said last year there would be electricity shortages. Maybe, maybe not. But what his advice is, stock up now on long life food. Just in case. You don't have to suddenly go out and clear the shelves. But just make sure you have long life food in the press. Because he says, what is happening now we have not seen in our life before. And he says there's not going to be very much production of cooking oil, for instance. And it comes from the sunflower in Ukraine, which for obvious reasons has not been produced in great quantities. You've got the cost of fertilisers, and some farmers didn't fertilise this year. So all in all, he sees a bit of a perfect storm coming together for food supplies. Pat McDonough of Supermax, you can read it in the Irish Independent, believe it or not. Now, Gorthy are going to be sympathetic. We'll take this with a pinch of salt. The Irish Examiner tells us that if you are driving around without a valid NCT cert, they will understand the system is clogged by delays. And there are some test centres that require a 6-month wait before you get an appointment. And I'm curious what the local centres are telling you if you've tried to book recently. Because the Irish Examiner, of course, is a Munster paper. It quotes Cathair Sibhín, for instance. Cathair Sibhín, the earliest appointment you'll get is November. Tralee, November. Killarney, early December. So if you're applying to Tullamore, to Mullingar, to Portlaoise, what answers are you getting? Fewer and fewer children are doing this, which a few years ago, certainly decades ago, was very commonplace. Starting school at the age of 4. So in the 90s, nearly half of all junior infants were aged 4. Last January, only about 1 in 6. Now I can recall 1985, 1985, I started primary school. And I was 4 years and 2 months. And one girl actually came in about 2 weeks after the start of school. Dearon Dowling. Good morning, Dearon, if you're listening. She had only just turned four that September. So the pressure on parents was to get kids into school as early as possible, the moment their birthday came along. And these days, you're encouraged to wait until they're five. Oh, they'll be more mature. They'll be better able to absorb all the learning. They'll have grown up a bit more, etc. Do you buy into that? I'm just curious, why wait? Is it that whole argument? Or are you willing to get them out the door the moment they turn four? Ah, away from under my feet. In you go. Which is your policy? Zig and Zag, speaking of things from the past, Zig and Zag have been killed off. Oh no. They were taken and brought before the firing squad following a period of nostalgia on the Den. You remember the Den appeared and disappeared rather quickly during the COVID lockdown. Well, the producers believe that what they need to do now is create global characters. Global characters who can be sold off around the world. And that will bring in cash to RTE's starved coffers. Aye. Anyway, that's a selection of what's in your newspapers this morning. Now, if you're a fan of Nathan Carter, we have another opportunity for you to win a pair of tickets to see him live in the Mullingar Park Hotel. He shall perform on the 1st of August. That's Monday, Bank Holiday Monday. And the tickets come, compliments of our friends, at Collinstown Farmers Market, which you can enjoy every second Sunday between 11:30 and 1:30. Something for everybody. And the next market will be held on the 7th of August. So, Collinstown Farmers Market, supporting local suppliers in your area. Check out Collinstown Farmers Market on Facebook. And for that competition, for your chance to win a great night out with Nathan Carter in concert, go to the Midlands 103 Facebook page right now. Pick a number between 22 and 30. Decided yet? 22 to 30? Yeah, how come negotiations on this farm issue are taking so long? And they're continuing today, and they may continue tomorrow, and they may even be kicked till September. What does the conversation sound like? Why does it take hours? Get out and get some fresh air and help a great cause on Sunday, the 7th of August. Specifically, the Irish Wheelchair Association and Mullingar Resource Centre. Now, here comes the difficult part. You are invited to participate in the Kilbeggan 10-mile run. Yes, 10 miles. I thought about this myself. And once upon a time, 10 miles, you could have just about managed it. Can I walk? Can I crawl? Anyway, myrunresults.com. If you're a sporty spice, if you're willing to sign up, and you will get your race number sent to you. You'll get your finisher's medal on the day. Myrunresults.com, and you're searching for Kilbeggan 10 mile. And your effort will support the Irish Wheelchair Association, Mullingar Resource Centre. Now, let's move back to this dispute between the Green Party and their partners in government. A number between 22 and 30. That's the percentage by which agricultural emissions will have to be reduced between now and the year 2030. But they're not settling just yet. Talks continue today between the three party leaders. They had broken up without a resolution last night, although some sources have said the gap on a figure is closing. An agreement might even be reached today, but there's optimism certainly for the next few days. Let's hear from Independent TD Michael Fitzmaurice. He says the two main parties in government need to stop being pushed around by the Greens.
I think that it's time that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil stand up for the simple reason. The Greens are a small minority, or a small part of this government. I think it's 12 TDs they have. And, you know, it's like the pup is wagging the dog's tail at the moment.
Paul Hosford is political reporter with the Irish Examiner. He's kept his ear to the ground. Good morning, Paul.
Morning, Will.
Is it as easy as Michael Fitzmaurice suggests? They've got the numbers, so Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael should put the Greens in their place.
No, I think I don't think it's anything is as simple as that. I suppose that there's a couple of things to keep in mind when you think about this entire discussion. One is that the three government parties signed up in the programme for government to cut Ireland's emissions by 51% by 2030. When we announced the climate action plan before Christmas, we knew that there would be sectoral targets. The departments have kind of been tic-tacking over the last couple of months about what those targets are. We knew that agriculture, which is the largest emitter in our society, we knew that agriculture would land somewhere between 22 and 30% in the last couple of weeks. It's ramped up to a point where the sticking point is what end of the scale you're on. I think the two larger government parties are keenly aware that this is a very, very important issue for the Green Party. Within the Green Party, there's a huge sense of, not stubbornness, but they're definitely willing to really, really lay down on this issue. Some in the Green Party feel that they've gone back on party policy on things like the National Maternity Hospital. They're going to ask their TDs to vote on the CETA trade deal in a couple of months. And I suppose the justification from some of the Green Party has always been, we can take losses in certain places because we're going to get a huge win on the environment and on climate change. And if the Green Party rolls back on this, then many of their members will look around and say, well, what was all of that for? What was all of the other stuff that we rolled over on for? Mm. So I don't think it's as easy as the two parties to have the numbers pushing around the party which doesn't. Because, look, the Green Party chairperson, Senator Pauline O'Reilly, she said that her party would have to convene a meeting to discuss its future in government if the party is asked to accept the figure of 22 or 23% cut to agriculture emissions.
So this is a red line issue for them, to use that hackneyed phrase.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, they are the Green Party. That is, it should be their red line issue. Their one big issue should be the environment, should be climate change. That's what they sold themselves as in the last election. The other factor is that nobody really wants an election right now. It would be very, very complicated to actually have one because the Electoral Commission hasn't been established. We know that we're going to need more TDs. The boundaries and the constituencies haven't been set because the body which is supposed to draw them up has only been established really in law, or that the primary legislation underpinning it has only been passed a couple of weeks. It would be really, really complicated to have an election in the next couple of weeks. Nobody really wants it anyway, not least the two parties which are the larger parties in government, because their polling hasn't been great. I think if the government fell over a row about emissions targets, specifically when there's no specifics here, what's being discussed is just the broad figure. It's not necessarily how you get to 22 or 28 or 30%. Nobody's
in that case, Paul, why is it taking so long? Because if you and I were haggling over something that you were selling for 30 quid and I was willing to pay 22, it wouldn't take us that long to either walk away or find a solution.
Yeah, this is one of the things that we've asked. I asked the government spokesperson yesterday, are we literally just passing back a piece of paper that has 22% or 24% or 30% written on it? And it seems to be that there's just a lot of political considerations. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael's backbench TDs, rural backbench TDs, have been very vocal on this issue. They don't want to have to face down their own TDs. They certainly don't want to have to go back and explain to farmers. I suppose one of the issues is that explanation to farmers or that communication to farmers about what a cut would actually mean. Now, I was in Asia with the Taoiseach last week, and one of the things that the Taoiseach puts huge stock in is this idea of new technologies. He wasn't very specific on what new technologies are, but speaking to some people who are far more familiar with a farm than I am, you could probably tell from the accent that I don't spend a whole lot of time on farms. Right. But speaking to people who have, they say that there are technologies that exist. There are technologies that could cut into farming emissions by, you know, between 8 and 10% right now, but they're expensive. And it's a very tough sell to go back to farmers who we know have been earning less and who have been hit by the cost of living increase as much, if not more, than a lot of people, you know. So, I was chatting to somebody who was saying that a bag of fertilizer has gone from about €320 to €980. So it's tough to go to those people and say, okay, here's an extra cost for something that you necessarily, like, look, farmers are not blind to the challenges of climate change or biodiversity loss.
I agree with you, but I'm wondering then, there must be some policy discussion within the conversations taking place where at least they say, if we're going to require farmers to invest in cleaner technology, we're going to make a grant scheme available or a subvention available. Surely in very broad strokes, the details being discussed.
Yeah, and I think that's the likelihood of where we land. We probably will end up somewhere in the middle on this figure. I don't think either party is going to claim a massive win or a massive loss. I think it'll probably be 24-25% with a review in 2025 is probably the most likely at this moment. But it will come with grant aid or some kind of incentive for farmers, because you know there was a scheme launched a couple of weeks ago to incentivize farmers in terms of biodiversity on their farms, and at the press conference for that, Charlie McConnell was very, very clear that the government is not necessarily interested in using the stick method with farmers on biodiversity and on climate change. They understand that having farmers come along with them, having farmers be the ones to sell the benefits of these lifestyle changes or these practice changes is the best way of doing things. If you have a farmer who's able to go out into their community and say, look, I got this grant to change my practice around anaerobic digestion or around, you know, maybe switching the fuel sources of the vehicles that you're using. If you're able to go into the community and say, look, I got that, it didn't affect me, I can still, you know, I can still farm the way that I was, but it's cleaner. It's far better for that to come from a farmer than for it to come from the government. So the government understands this. So we probably will end up with some kind of grant aid, some kind of program to roll out to encourage farmers to come along on this journey, as we all have to.
Another party we haven't mentioned so far, the main opposition, Sinn Féin, and where they stand on the 22 to 30% range. Do we know?
No, it's the short answer. Their party's spokesperson on climate and transport, Aaron O'Rourke, had a briefing on the Lenzley House plinth on Tuesday, and said that they have no view on the level of emission cuts that should be set. They said that basically they cannot come up with a figure because there's a report being compiled for the government by McKinsey, and until they've seen that figure or that report, they won't know what end the cuts should be. Now, that hasn't stopped Social Democrats or People for Profit who want to hit the upper limit. Labour kind of indicated that they would favour the upper end of that scale, but Sinn Féin very reluctant to commit to a figure, just saying that they don't have enough information. But the question was put to Darren O'Rourke, well, will that mean that you will support the government, whatever it does? Because if you're saying that the report is the key, if they've seen the report, then are you taking on face value that whatever they decide is right? And I suppose the answer to that was kind of not really. We kind of reserved the right to criticise the government's moves.
Well, Brian Stanley was the environment spokesperson in the last Dáil. I understand he'll be speaking with our news team a little bit later today, and be interesting to hear his take on this, whether a number is produced or not. Paul, grateful for your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Will.
Paul Hosford is political reporter with the Irish Examiner. Latest grocery figures show we're buying more own brand products than was the case last year, probably in response to the cost of living. Are there any other tips to save money? to try and keep the bills to a minimum. Mrs. Smart Money is next. Become caller of the day, and you could sample a taste of Laois with thanks to O'Gorman's of Kilminchy, the Grain and Grill Bar in the Maldron, the Charter Bar and Eatery in the Midlands Park Hotel, the Cedar Bar and Rooms in the Collession Hotel, and the Bog Road, all in Port Laois. But if you don't become caller of the day and you still have to do the grocery shopping, let's see, can we help you there as well? Because new research from Kantar shows we are buying more own brand products than was the case last year. And no doubt that's because own brands tend to be cheaper. And heaven knows the cost of living in particular. Food prices have been going in one direction and one direction only. That's up. Kel Gallivan is with us. Mrs. Smart Money from Kildare. Hello, Kel. How are you?
I am very good. It's good to be here today.
And you can be found on Instagram and lots of ways to follow your blogs and your insights. And we spoke before and you had, in effect, a no-spend year, if I recall the conversation. And it really made you thrifty and economical and therefore very well equipped in times like this to offer some advice and insights. So how can we try and keep the grocery bill to a minimum?
You're spot on with that. Like, the grocery bill, it's one of the biggest expenses that we have. If you think about it, there's a thing called the fat expenses, food, accommodation, and transport. And they actually, across Ireland, cost people about half their income every month when you actually look at the household budget survey and stuff. So food itself is a huge chunk of that. So getting that under control, it's a great way to save money, but it's also a great way to kind of relieve stress when it comes to all those outgoings, because there's so much going on at the moment. It can seem a bit overwhelming, but if you just focus on even just the grocery budget alone as a start and have a few wins there, you're going to feel more in control, you're going to feel better and all those good things. But one of the first places I would recommend people kind of start is, and I'm sure they've heard it before, but it's never been more important, is to have a grocery list.
So are there items you're striking from the grocery list that 12 months ago would have been on there?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. So it's not necessarily that things are cut out. It's just to think a little bit more about how you go about shopping. So, like, for example, there could be particular meals you like to cook. But if a lot of the shops now, they have, like, you know, a Super 6, and they have, you know, good value depending on the season. And they tend to be the more seasonal fruit and veg that you get on special offer. So it's usually that's a little bit fresher and it's in season. It's nice to eat in season as well. And if you can swap out certain things that are on special offer this week, you know, so if you're having a bit of meat with veg and potatoes, just be flexible on what type of veg you put into it. It doesn't always have to be a particular one. You just look at what's on promotion. And that's a nice way to kind of save money a little bit. And another kind of way as well is meat is getting more and more expensive. And I'm sure anybody who bought a roast recently will just see, whoa, it's not as the Sunday roast can get quite pricey. So maybe to counteract that a bit, because it's nice to have that as a nice, lovely family meal, but to counteract that, then maybe during the week have meat-free meals. And they don't have to be all piles of vegetables and stuff if that's not your thing, but it could be a nice pasta dish, a tomato-based pasta dish, or it could be an omelette or a quiche, or, you know, something just nice like that that's tasty. And that will help balance out the nights where you do have meat. It's not going to put you under as much pressure.
What's your opinion on the own brand goods? Because if they were as good as the real thing, should we be buying them all along?
I think it really depends, right? There'll be a lot of staples that you can move to own brand, no problem at all. I think there'll be sometimes there's a particular brand you like or it might taste slightly different. And definitely keep those. If there's one or two things that you absolutely love and you really enjoy and they're branded and they cost a little bit more, that's fine. But then if something doesn't matter as much, so let's say you don't mind what flour you use, well, then maybe go to own brand flour. But if there's a one particular biscuit and you just love it and it's just your treat, you know, maybe keep that, but, you know, change your flour or your milk or your bread or something like that just to balance out the cost. But definitely make it personal to yourself because you have to enjoy your food as well.
Alcohol is one area where the own brand doesn't offer the price saving anymore because of the minimum unit pricing. Any thoughts around that?
Yeah, but alcohol will always be a personal choice with people. I think just when it comes to that, with the minimum unit pricing, yes, it has brought a more of a level playing field when it comes to pricing. So, yes, still enjoy your drink, but you know, have it on one night a week, or you know, just work it out for yourself that way, because it is a personal choice. And maybe if you have a mixer, maybe buy the own brand mixer, or you know, have one less and just make the bottle last longer, that sort of thing. But just be more flexible with it, because you don't have to cut these things out. And sometimes having things a bit less makes them more of a treat when you do have them.
Interesting text from Elaine, who says, the big challenge is time. If you have enough time, you can go from supermarket to supermarket, comparing the specials and making the best choice week to week. But when you're working and still commuting, you don't have that luxury. You have to go to the one supermarket more or less all the time. It's harder to realise the savings. And she asks, is there any way to compare the specials online before you go into the store? Interesting one. You probably just go onto the supermarket website. I don't think there's a price comparison site for them, is there?
I don't believe so, but she's made a really good point. And there are a couple of ways around it. This might help her. So like, when you are working full-time or if you have young kids at home, like it's not that easy to get up to the supermarket, and particularly to go to two or three to get the best prices. And there's also a balance between the time you spend. You don't want to spend all day doing your grocery shopping. You want to kind of get it done.
No, I mean, you have to value your own time as well.
Exactly. You'll hear me say this a lot. It's all about balance. So maybe for her, what might be an option is that if there's some evening, you know, when maybe the kids are gone to bed and she has an hour or so and she's not hungry and she has a little bit of time, to maybe actually do online shopping and get the shopping delivered. Now, I know you have to pay a little bit for that, but a couple of things will happen. It'll save her making that trip and spending that time. It will mean that she can shop at a time when she's organized and she's in the right headspace for it. And there's less temptation to pick up extra items, which can often cost way more than what you would save in the delivery. So that might be a very good option for her there.
Kel, always great chatting with you. Mrs. Smart Money, look her up online. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Still to come today, how do you go to work in a prison every single day in company of some of the most dangerous people in the country, who from time to time can show remarkable decency as well? Fishman has put together a bestseller, and he'll be here to share some of the insights, not all of them, some of the insights from around 20 past 10. And with the fine weather now thankfully with us, and hopefully for the bank holiday, although it'll be a little unsettled from time to time, if you're having a nice outdoor barbecue, why not have a cocktail or a mocktail as well? Some recipe ideas. And some businesses say they're starting to slow down. Sentiment is on the decline. And even IBEC, which represents Irish businesses far and wide, big and small, it's saying a change is happening. But are we talking ourselves into a recession? Is there really, really that sign of a slowdown? We'll be taking some samplings from around the region of different businesses. When you call 0818 300 103 is my number. You can text, you can WhatsApp 083 30 10 103. But first, we need your help. And, well, the more people who can join in the search, the more people who can keep their eyes peeled, the more likely we are to reunite somebody with their family. And the Gorthy are appealing for information about the whereabouts of Andrea McCullum. She is 49 years of age. She has been missing from Nerney in County Kildare since Wednesday the 20th of July. And there has been a report of a sighting in the Port Arlington area. But let's get into what we know with Lorraine McCullum, who is Andrea's sister. Lorraine, good morning.
Good morning.
Or Lorraine Fitzgerald, I believe, is... to get up to date on the name. Tell us about Andrea.
Andrea is a gentle, gentle soul. She absolutely loves nature, animals. She spent all her working life with on stud farms with horses. She would have a great affinity with animals. She's also a wonderful, wonderful artist. Very talented, very creative, but just a very quiet, quiet person. Lives a very solitary life. Just her dogs, animals when she worked, and her little smoke, her cigarette, and a cup of coffee. She likes the simple things in life. That, I think, sums Andrea up.
We have a photo on Midlands103.com. Always a picture paints a thousand words, but could you give us a physical description of her?
Yes, Andrea, I'm estimating 5'6", a very slim build. In a woman's numbers, she'd be a size 8. She's got short, dark hair, a bit of wave in it, blue eyes, and she would have a soft Donegal accent. I think that's...
I was about to ask, what form was she in when you were last talking with her?
She was in good enough form. Andrea's had a bit of ill health for the last while, awaiting a diagnosis. So her world has been turned upside down in that regard.
Right, but of course.
She's in good spirits, physically well, mobile, active, very active, walked daily.
I think you were about to tell us, when she was last seen, she was wearing a grey hoodie, dark bottoms and runners. And when she was last seen, now I just want to confirm with you, because there's a report of a CCTV footage which offers some promise in the Port Arlington area.
It does indeed. Andrea went missing on Wednesday night. So the clothes she was wearing on Wednesday night are the clothes that are listed in the appeal. However, the CCTV footage shows her with a light-coloured T-shirt, light-coloured trousers and light-coloured shoes that she possibly changed into or purchased. I'm really not sure. She was carrying what looked like the light grey hoodie that she was wearing on the day that she went missing. She has a not a full-size rucksack backpack. It would be a slightly smaller, either a navy or a dark grey or even possibly black rucksack.
When was the sighting in Port Arlington, Lorraine?
The sighting on CCTV was at 17:38 at the Maxall station, on the corner of the road that would lead you down to the train station in
yes.
Port.
Know it well, yes. And was that also on the Wednesday, or was it since the Wednesday?
No, that was on the Friday. Andrea went missing on the 20th, and that was Friday the 22nd. So a week tomorrow is her last 100% confirmed sighting of Andrea. We would presume that if she were heading in that direction, that she would have possibly made her way to the train station. However, CCTV has, she's not showing up that we can see at the moment. That's not to say she didn't.
Yes, but so there's a possibility she's still in the Port Arlington area. So in particular, if you're living there, if you're around the town, just take a look at that photo on Midlands103.com. You may well recognise the lady in it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And unfortunately for you, Lorraine, as far as breadcrumbs are concerned, she doesn't have a phone with her. She doesn't have any credit cards that can be traced.
Absolutely nothing. Should she be found, she has no form of ID whatsoever on her. Not a wallet, not a purse, nothing. Absolutely nothing on her person that could identify her. And the appeal would really be, if anyone is in any way suspects that they've seen her, to please, please, please contact their local Garda.
Well, it sounds like you're getting good cooperation from the Gorthy, at least.
Absolutely, yes, I absolutely am, indeed. We are.
Lorraine, let the word go far and wide. I hope that she is found safe and well, and hopefully quickly as well, so your mind can be at ease. Thank you for taking our call.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Thank you.
That's Lorraine Fitzgerald. She's the sister of Andrea McCullum. Last seen in that CCTV footage in Port Arlington. So if you are in the town, as I said, just take a quick look at a picture. You might recognise her or be able to point to where she was, at least. And the Garda Confidential line, they're putting a a jigsaw together, and with your assistance, hopefully all the pieces will come into place. 1800 treble six treble one. That's Gartha Confidential. 1800 treble six treble one. It seems George Clooney is coming to Ireland again. A spokesperson says he was adamant to visit in 2020, but he couldn't because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So now plans are afoot for the summer. And I'm sure you want to know, do those plans include County Laois as they did on the last occasion? Well, we haven't been able to reach George Clooney, but we have been able to reach a man who looks just like him. That's Andy Ring. Good morning.
How are you having, Will? I'm great. How are you, Will?
I'm in good form. I know you met him the last time. Will you refresh our memories, please?
Well, I was just talking to Seamus Clooney the other night. I told him they're writing back and forward, and it's known as snail mail now, isn't it, Will? And they've intended coming before the end of the summer. That's George and NL and Nick and Leona. That's George and his wife and their parents. The last time he was here, he came as far as Ballyfane. We couldn't get him to come into Aberdeen, but he came as far as Ballyfane. The cameras were, there was cameramen after him. I had a camera there myself, wouldn't have had any photographs in the newspapers of George Clooney's first visit to Ireland, Will.
Well, I'm looking at the picture, and the two of you look quite chummy. What did you talk about?
We were there for 4 hours, and I was sitting right across from him, because I was with Seamus, so I was right across from him. Seamus was across from his wife, and I was sitting right across from George Clooney for 4 hours. And I just remember looking at Graham Norton a few years ago interviewing George Clooney, and I said, geez, Graham Norton is a brilliant interviewer. Look at you just turn up. There's no interviewing George Clooney. He just is an entertainer. From the time he sat down for 4 hours, he was just great crack. And he has it all. He has it all. Charisma, comedy. He's a comedian. He has everything. I mean, he's just incredible. And a really nice guy at the end of the day. Well, a really nice guy. A real Clooney. They're really lovely family. Well, can I talk about somebody else who's important in these besides George Clooney?
You are. I was about to ask, actually, whether he was going to make it to the Abbey Leagues Heritage Arts Festival.
Oh, thank you very much.
I thought you might like to mention that.
The good news is I'm going to spend a few bob, which is so in the advertising, so we're going to exhale for a change, but we're not going to inhale all the time. And I appreciate all the time you're giving me on the air, so we're going to spend a few bob with the letter or three on the Arts Festival. Yeah, thank you very much for bringing that up. The reason why I was talking to an artist the other day, actually, this is a bit fun, this is to give you a laugh, and I just said to him, he said to me, but what about Kilkenny and Galway and Clonmel and Kerr? I said, you ever watch those Marvel movies, Avengers? You ever said there was a line in it recently, and I'm going, we've got a Hulk. Well, Kilkenny and Clonmel and Kerr and Galway don't have a Hulk. We've got a Hulk. We've got Francis Bacon.
Go on. What's the Hulk link to Francis Bacon?
Well, we've got Francis Bacon. Nobody else has someone as renowned an artist in Ireland as Francis Bacon. He's a world-renowned international artist who lived in Aberdeen. Now, he's not the only artist who lived in Aberdeen. In actual fact, the most famous person who lived in Aberdeen left Aberdeen in 1847. And you know what I'm going to talk about. His name is Long Thompson, who was one of the most famous sculptors in America. And he was born, he left Aberdeen with his widowed mother in 1847. You want to hear about this guy?
We talked about him before, Mr. Yes, Thompson, but I'm curious, I'm still not getting the Hulk connection. So Francis Bacon, did he depict the Hulk?
No. Did you see the movie, the Avengers movie?
I'm sorry, I'm rather sheltered.
Okay, well, it's Marvel. I like science fiction, I like escapism. Well, anyway, also, the photography in those is fantastic, in those Marvel movies. The photography and lighting is incredible. That's why I like them as well. But just getting back to our arts festival. Okay, well, if I talk about that for a minute, because it's in aid of a very good charity, Laois Down Syndrome, and Aberdeen's Field of Dreams. I mean, Laois County Council of Fairness gave Laois Down Syndrome 4 acres in Aberdeen to build.
Yeah, it's going to be a stunning facility when it's built.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. So this is the first effort to make a few bob for the Down Syndrome Aberdeen venture. And I'd like to give you an opportunity to thank Morrissey's Pub, which is under new management, are the main sponsors. I'm delighted to have them on board. And I'll be sending you an invite to the press launch there on a separate email just today.
Look forward to it.
And we want to thank Rene PR Design in Port Leash, who have been playing a blinder because they're really working.
Andy, you realise this is live. Do you want to tell people why they should go to the festival?
All right, of course, absolutely. Well, we have 12 of Leash's best artists. Well, not the best, but some of the best artists. We've got 12 of them showing 10 of their works. That's 120 pieces of work, well, over a weekend. And we have 7 locations in Abelix: Morrissey's, Papinoni's, the Gary Kitchen at Brownlee's, Mullen O'Connell, and McAvoy's Steak and Wine Bar, and of course Morrissey's. Morrissey's that's where the press launch is. So that's where now also we'll have music with 4 or 5 bands. We've got 4, we may have 5 on the Saturday, the 13th of August. So it's kicking off on 12th, 13th, and 14th of August.
And is George Clooney going to be there? We all want to know.
We sent him an invitation. We did send him an invitation.
Okay, well, that's good.
And he did say he would come back, and next time he comes back, he'll come to Abelix. So we're going to hold him to that. I watched a program last night, while I'm on here now, a YouTube, if you look up Lon Thompson, Michael Burke, who's a friend of mine now at this stage, I've talked to him for 8 years, in New York, and he was on talking to Elizabeth Stack, who's the executive director of the Irish American Heritage Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And we're discussing the trip that myself and Mike Bunn were supposed to go to America and take photographs of Mike Bunn's or of Lon Thompson's works, but it never happened. But Michael Burke, unfortunately, he even went to West Point. He was explaining to Elizabeth Stack, he even went to West Point to get permission for myself and Mike Bunn to get in, because there's 5 or 6 of Lon Thompson's pieces of work in there.
Andy, I'm lost. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm lost again. But I'm getting the impression it's going to be a rather busy festival. George Clooney might be there. And either way, I'm sure you'll be chatting to him, and I'm sure it'll be a long conversation.
It will. And we're hoping to have somebody from the Hugh Lane studio in Dublin, which is dedicated to Francis Bacon, speaking at the launch also. And maybe someone might be there from the Hugh Lane at the actual event itself.
Okay. When is the launch, Andy?
It's on the 4th. I'm not going to say where.
Okay, good stuff. We keep the secret. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Sorry about that, Will. Thanks, Will.
Me, Will. Bye. You, Andy. Good stuff. That man should be a sports commentator. He can certainly talk. Value for money from Andy, who met George Clooney on the last occasion he visited these shores, and the actor's spokesperson has confirmed another trip to Ireland is on the cards. Now, the only dispute, of course, is some of his family hail from Abelix and some come from Windgap in Kilkenny, and sure, maybe he'll land somewhere in between. Who knows? Now, this is the best-selling book in the country at the moment, and it's called Unlocked, an Irish prison officer's story. And a Leash man is here to share it with you. Good morning, David MacDonald. How are you?
I'm good, Will. Thank you for having me on the show. Delighted to be here.
Your dad was a dub, and he wanted to get out of Dublin and move down to Port Leash, and I think you were only 4 years of age at the time, and to a Port Leash that, of course, had 2 prisons, 1 very high security, times of trouble as well. What are your memories of and impressions of the prison as a young fella?
Well, you're right. We moved down when I was about 4, which I suppose still makes me a blow-in. I'll always be from outside. My dad is a pure dub, grew up in Ringsend. I went initially to the school and started the C in Sannymount. Came down to Port Leash. Port Leash was a very different town, as a lot of the towns were back then. It was, everyone knew everyone. The prison dominated the town, and to some degree still does. Mm. And then we have the addition of the Midlands Prison, which is the biggest prison in the country, has been built since. Port Leash back then was a very tense place. It had a disproportionate amount of Gardaí because of the prison being there, detective units, what have you. Prison officers, it was the main employer. Prison officers were big, tough men back then. Mm. I'm not saying they're not tough now, they can be.
No, but was that just through a child's eyes? Because I know you said in the book, you know, sometimes you were afraid of friends' dads. and we won't even mention girlfriends' dads.
Not quite, Will, because later on I would have gone to work with these guys. So they were tough men. they were doing a very difficult job, as are all prison officers when they go into behind the gates and the walls of these prisons. They do a superb job and under very, very difficult circumstances. So Portlaoise was quite tense because of the subversives, what we know as the Troubles. So we had INLA prisoners, IRA, and a good few hundred of them locked up in Portlaoise.
You also got to meet these guys in their downtime, though. You worked in a bar.
I did, and I would have went to school with prison officers' sons and daughters, and even tried on a few occasions to date the odd one, which wasn't
Brave
very
man.
Successful. And like prison officers socialised together. Everything was kept secret. So they socialised together, they went on holidays together, and it was very obvious that there was a very strong bond between prison officers. I had a huge curiosity, obviously, like everyone does when they go by those big walls and what's in behind them. So it was quite an easy fit, I suppose, as time went on. Like, just to give you an example, Will, just under half my Leaving Cert class worked in the prison service.
Wow. Wow. But you, like, I suppose many people, get to a certain age, you want to put Portlaoise in the rearview mirror, go off to the brighter lights of Dublin. But you end up coming back. Your first stint in the prison service, though, is Mountjoy.
My first stint was in Mountjoy. Yes, look, I was lucky. After kind of Leaving Cert, I went to the College of Marketing Design. I had great plans of becoming a hotel manager. I took off for a year to France. I worked in the Pyrenees Atlantic region for a year for a co-op. So I got a little bit of travelling when travelling wasn't quite what it is today. We had no Ryanairs or, you know, travel was expensive. So I came back. My first day was in Mountjoy Prison. I was assigned to an experienced prison officer, a Mr. Clear, who I know he won't mind me mentioning him. He was an exceptional person to be given to on the first day. And it was a little bit of a baptism of fire. We had a number of prisoners on the B1 landing that decided they would rob glue from a workshop and sniff the glue and forward and barricade themselves into a cell. So as things work in a prison, everything gets, at tea time, gets locked down, and down came the lads with what's called the universal key, sledgehammers, and decided to take the walls down either side of the lads who would barricade themselves in the door. One gentleman, I can still remember to this day, as he came out the door, he had quite a bald, round head, God love him, and he got a slap. I won't say where, but this eye fell out and ran right between my legs.
Jeez.
Now, as it turned out, I didn't quite know at the time, but it was a glass eye, thank God. So a bit like school, you kind of your first day, you get to finish a little bit early. So after that incident, I kind of went home and I just went, my God, what have I done?
Well, yeah, and I imagine for many reasons, Mountjoy in those days wouldn't have had sanitation either.
No, there was no in-cell sanitation. So as a young officer in Mountjoy, one of my jobs would be 8:15 in the morning to stand down at the end of a landing while the chamber pots, all the prisoners would come down with their chamber pots, usually full of urine, some of them sometimes spilling a little bit, and they'd empty it into what's called a sluice, which is a big, huge sink. So the stink and the smells was anything but Pleasantville. You know.
I'm not going to ask you why you didn't walk away, because that question comes later.
Okay.
Because there are many points in the book where I found myself asking that question, why doesn't he walk away? Talk to us about coming back then to your hometown.
Well, coming back to Portlaoise, we had a house in Dublin. We had our first child, Simon. It was a small house. It was tiny. So it wasn't that I didn't like Mountjoy, and certainly I'm actually a big fan of Dublin. I think Dublin's a fantastic city. But it was just an economic one. We could sell our house in Dublin for X amount, buy somewhere a lot bigger in Portlaoise or the surrounding area for, you know, a lot less money. And I had to kind of still that curiosity. I mean, I used to walk by Portlaoise prison every day of my life and I wanted to get in behind the walls. Portlaoise, back then, it was pre-Good Friday Agreement. So I was going into a prison with a couple of hundred subversives still incarcerated there.
And but they almost had a self-discipline.
No, they actually did. They had their own commanding officers. For example, at night time, we didn't go down and put prisoners into their cells, you know, shout, you know, bang them up, bang them out. Their commanding officer would go to the top of the landing in Gaelic, call their soldiers, as they saw them, to attention, give them the order to about turn. And with that, then they'd go into their cells and then we'd go down and lock the cells secure. So they were very much, they saw themselves as a military force and they operated that way. So they didn't speak to us. So they, if they had a request, they went to the commanding officer would have gone to our chief officer or the governor of the prison. Mm. And they kind of self-managed themselves to a certain degree. So, for example, if a prisoner got out on temporary release for a wedding, a baptism, a funeral or whatever, the rule was if he didn't come back, the next guy didn't get it. So we had occasions where certain people were brought back by the provost in the boot of a car and dumped at the gate of the prison of Portlaoise. Wow. A little bit worse for wear, to be honest.
The profile of the prisoner changes during your service and criminality in Ireland becomes a lot more professional, and you get these gangs and some of the figures become household names almost, glorified in the press. So just talk to us from your perspective how that change unfolds.
Well, the prison sometimes, while the staff that are on the floor at the coalface doing an amazing job, from other areas, they often have to wait till there's something goes really wrong and then there's a knee-jerk reaction to it. So there's a famous phone call to the Joe Duffy show from a prisoner called Daly, John Daly. And that was in 2007. And this prisoner was on E1 Landing inside the block of which is probably the most high security prison in Europe. And he has access to a phone and able to ring a live radio show. There was this reaction, as there often is in the prison service. And a unit was set up called the Operation Support Group, OSG for short. So I was asked to join that unit in 2008 at its formation. And this unit was set up primarily to disrupt gang activity, gather intelligence, and start restricting massively the amount of contraband that enters the prison estates. So mobile phones, drugs, weapons. Believe it or not, up to 2008, only one prison in Ireland had a screening area. That was Portlaoise. Nowhere else did. So it was very easy for people to bring in drugs and contraband. So we set up screening areas similar to what you'd see at the airports. We were a three-pronged unit. We had a canine unit, which had passive drug dogs, which every visitor must go through before entering the prison. We had what was called conflict resolution dogs, which is a very fancy title for German shepherds, who were a very useful tool in controlling certain situations.
Yes, although they would distinguish between their handlers and everybody else. Not necessarily, you know, the good guys and the bad guys.
No, they danced to one tune, and that was the handlers. Everyone else is fair game. But these dogs were massively trained at huge expense, but they worked for the handler, incredibly intelligent animals. So we had to learn certain procedures. So we wanted, if we were there in full riot gear, we usually have what's called long shields, short shields. Mm-hmm. Long shields are about 5 foot long. We would actually form a corridor where these shields interlock with each other. And if the shepherds were coming, then we were with the shields behind. The dogs would have a tunnel. They go down it. They would absolutely obey the handler's commands. They were fantastic animals.
Very regimented as well. The screening obviously created scarcity within the prison of all of this contraband, and that changes the economics in prison as well, doesn't it?
It does. You see, you will have, like, you read about these gang leaders getting, you know, sentences, and they're quite a long, sometimes in many cases, they're very long sentences. But their little empires on the outside don't stop. And once they come inside the walls of a prison, they're also trying to control certain aspects in the prison environment. So we took the power away from a lot of these guys. And mobile phones have a huge value in prisons. So you're talking about a 20, 30 euro mobile phone, which you might buy in Tesco, is the cheap of the cheapest, could fetch anything between 1,800 and 2,200 euros behind the wall of a prison. Mm. A pill that you might buy at a nightclub that might cost 2-3 euros, that pill could actually go to somewhere like 15, you know, behind the wall. Mm. Everything is much more expensive because of how, you know, it's supply and demand.
Yes,
will.
Yeah.
And mobile phones were a massive thing because with the phones, these gang leaders could still control to some degree their empires outside. So we had to block these, and we tried many different ways, and it did become a game where they would find a way of getting stuff in. We would find a way of blocking it. They'd find a new way. We'd find a way of blocking it. And the book goes into that in quite detail. and Mick Clifford, the journalist who is very familiar to your listeners.
Yes, Irish Examiner.
Yeah, he's a fantastic journalist. And what Mick can do, which not many people, I believe, could do, is he doesn't just put words into a book. He's put the reader into the landings. You will smell it. You will hear it. You will experience what it's like. And that was, at the outset, what we had planned to try and achieve. We didn't believe that any other book had ever come on the market that would really show what it was like to be an inmate or a prison officer working behind the walls of one of our prisons. And Mick Clifford has done that exceptionally well.
Can I throw some names at you?
Of course.
And get some insights, because, again, we read about them in the papers, we hear about them on the radio. You worked face-to-face with some of these people. John Gilligan.
John Gilligan is a thug. No two ways about it. He's, like, he was never convicted of the murder of Ronan Cagirn. One of his sidekicks, Brian Meehan, was. And then there was a third person that would have been very much associated with John Gilligan, Paul Ward, and more that were up part of his gang. John Gilligan could turn on sixpence, blink of an eye. One moment charming, the next moment extremely violent. For a small man, and he is quite small, he had horrendous strength. He was a very strong individual. Now, there isn't a story in the book where John Gilligan actually saved my bacon.
Yeah.
On one occasion.
But do you reckon that was to show he had the power?
Yes, he did. And up to, say, 2008, he did have power, unfortunately. He was ruling the roost. And that changed with the introduction of a new governor into Portlaoise called Ned Whelan, who took control of the prison. He was what's called a campus manager of both Portlaoise and the Midlands prison. Now, he was a governor that I hugely respect. He was a big man. He was exceptionally good to work under. And he took, you know, he didn't take any nonsense from anyone. His nickname was Nike. Just do it. That was the...
Right.
Went with him. Right. But, just to give you an example, John Gilligan was used to walking into a governor's parade room and there was a chair there for him. So he'd sit down and he'd go in and he wouldn't just talk about what he required. Governor's parade is where a prisoner can go in and make requests, usually just for themselves, no one else. But John Gilligan was going in and making requests, not just for him, but for everyone else on E-Wing. E-Wing is, if anyone has ever passed by the Portlaoise, that big grey building, E1 is the ground floor, E2, 3 and 4. So E1 back then was known as the heavies. So you had the Gilligans, the Meehans, Christy Kinnan, these kind of type of guys. E2, 3 and 4 were subversives, INLA, IRA. So Gilligan sits, goes in, no chair. And he sort of says, where's my chair? And starts to go about getting one. Ned just says, you're the prisoner, I'm the governor, you stand. Then he started talking about who he represented. And Ned, in quite colourful language, told him he represents nobody. This might sound simple, but this was the start of taking back control away from these gang leaders and thugs. And that's, in many cases, that's what they are. Not all prisoners are as bad as each other. Yeah. We have a lot of mental health issues with prisoners inside prisons. And prisons aren't suitable for people, a lot of people that are in there, because we don't have the facilities to deal with prisoners that have serious, serious mental health issues. The job of a prison officer primarily is security and the safe custody of those inmates that's under.
Yeah, but it's not to be the psychiatric nurse or to try and ease their challenges or their demons. I'll throw another name at you, not from a gangland background, but again, very well known. Graham Dwyer.
Yeah, Graham Dwyer was someone I had a lot of dealings with. Once I joined the OSG in 2008, the OSG was an independent from the prison sites. So we had to be, because we were searching. We're searching prison officers, we're searching visitors. So we weren't answerable to the governors of the prison, which meant that we answered to our own command structure, which was set up in Arbor Hill, Ardnagriah. And once in the OSG, you would often be visiting a lot of prisons. So you weren't just confined always. At the time, I was an ACO, which is an assistant chief officer in the Midlands prison in charge of the OSG, but I would have visited many other prisons. And Graham O'Dwyer, you know, when he came in, like, what he did was horrific. What he's been doing time for is just horrible. But as a prisoner, prisoners like Graham O'Dwyer are very, very easy to manage will. They're not difficult. They're not violent, because they're not going to be violent to someone like me or my colleagues. They're going to be violent to vulnerable women and in some cases children and things like this. So he's, how would I describe him? He was a nine. He wouldn't use force to try and get what he wanted. He would always try and use dialogue and talk, but he was a whinger and still probably is. He was sweet. Certainly someone I found quite easy to deal with, because he got what he was entitled to and he, you know, he gets no more. He would try to befriend you, which certain prisoners will try to do. And that's a complete no-no in our job. We cannot be friends with prisoners. We have to keep that line very, very strong. You cannot be friends with someone that you're going to put behind a cell door and lock them in there, or take them down to reception and strip search them. That's not the basis of a friendship. So you have to be professional. You have to treat them as human beings. Absolutely, you can be polite, and on some occasions you can even have what you might call the crack with them.
Yeah, but
there is a line.
There's a line. And you detail in the book how some people cross that line. Other insights as well, having to watch certain videos that would come in and so on and so forth. There's a bit of sex in the book. There's also, again, towards the end, blowing the whistle. And we don't have time to get into it now. But again, the book is called Unlocked, An Irish Prison Officer's Story by David MacDonald. To conclude, working with these people, even going back to day one, that harrowing experience, that baptism of fire, why did you stick with it for so long?
I stuck with it, Will, because it was my job. And look, there's people out there do a lot more difficult jobs. I mean, I had death threats put on me. I had, you know, it wasn't always easy. But I mean, look, take the ambulance drivers that has to go to the scene of a car accident. And what they're going to experience and have to deal with is sometimes so stressful. Fire people, members of a Garda Síochána. So it was my job. I was good at it. I was professional at it. I enjoyed it. I had made some brilliant friends. I worked under some great management, and it was my career. And I was very fortunate, very, very fortunate and lucky to just have a very varied career. And that's all detailed in this book, Unlocked.
David MacDonald, thank you.
Thank you, Will.